Okay, morning everybody. Welcome to the next session. I'm delighted to have Nigel Wilson, the Group CEO of Legal & General, with me. So we've got a 40-minute session, and there'll be within that some Q&A at the end, so there'll be an opportunity to ask questions. So Nigel, maybe just to start off, results were pretty recent. What were the sort of standouts for you, and what would you like to do better in 2018?
Yeah, I think we saw success across the board. You know, double-digit earnings per share growth. You know, 30% increase in op profit and pre-tax profit. A 25% ROE meant that we were obviously doing a lot of things right. I think there's some areas of our insurance business that we need to get better at, and that's really the challenge in 17 and 18 to sort that out. All of the asset side of the businesses, LGR, LGM and LGC, had incredibly successful years, and I think we're going to have very successful 18s and 19s as well.
So looking at the, I think the sort of last slide of the results pack was the EPS outlook, and if you go back, you know, since the post-crisis period, you've had about sort of 10% compound EPS growth. Actually, the last couple of years has even been faster than that, and you've got this aspiration to sort of repeat that out to 2020. You know, what are the key levers in doing that? And I guess, you know, if I'm a cynic and looking at the sort of longevity releases you've had this year and last year, you know, can you get to the 10% without those releases? Are they baked in? You know, what's the real under? Because nobody's really growing EPS at that sort of rate without buybacks and without capital management.
Yeah, I think we can do it without buybacks and without capital management. And we've done it, as you said, for 7 or 8 years now. The operating profits for the divisions in 2007 were $650 million. Now they're $2.2 billion. So we've done, it's a fairly long-term trend. And we identify these long-term macro and demographic trends and have aligned the business to those. And we've been very fortunate in that things have turned out even better than we thought they would. And we see that in 2018 and beyond, that there's a huge amount of white space to expand into. And it's all about execution. The strategy's, you know, a very good strategy. It's delivered for a long period of time already. We just have to improve execution across the world. And, you know, we're in very early days in terms of our expansion into North America. The UK business is still growing tremendously quickly. And we've got a lot of optionality in Asia, where we've been sort of steadily moving the business forward in a very quiet way for the last 5 years.
Okay. And the dividend, you know, there was an inflection point 2 years ago when the growth rate slowed, having sort of, you know, recovered the dividend cut post-crisis and more. You've now been growing the dividend around sort of 7% a year. You know, the EPS is noticeably growing faster. Presumably there's an explicit aim there to increase the dividend cover over time, because the yield is pretty high already. How do you and the board think about the dividend policy going forward?
Yeah, I think we thought we'd set a rate of increase which everyone would be comfortable with. And so we sort of aimed off a little. You know, if earnings were going to grow close to double digits, then a 7% growth in DPS gave us a big extra headroom, yeah, in a sense that we even if we were slightly light on earnings in any one given year, we could easily make it up back to the dividend, to the DPS growth. And at the medium term, we're just going to continue with that consistency. There isn't really a dividend cover target in the sense is that the EPS is just is turning out to be probably a little bit better than the downside scenarios we had in our business plan.
Okay, and in the 10% growth, you're funding that with the 7% dividend growth, so there's no, all of this is sort of comfortably financed within that sort of dividend.
Well, I think we're generating obviously a lot more cash than, yeah, we're spending at the moment, and that's, so there's billions and billions and billions of it sitting on the balance sheet, which is acting as a drag on ROE, but it's a comfortable drag to have because we know that we can deploy it in appropriate ways that will earn a very high ROE for us, so it's just a phasing.
Okay. And you've done a lot of decluttering. You've had a lot of asset sales over the last few years. Are we done on that now? Is there anything left that you look at and think, you know, this is not actually a business which is going to win in the long run, or it's not positioned as well as we might hope?
Well, the decluttering, or, you know, has been a sensible thing to do. It's to build greater focus in the business, build more capability in the business. And it's allowed us really to build high quality management teams in high growth areas and not have them deflected working on things that we're not going to create much shareholder value. So we've got out of Germany, Italy, France, the Netherlands, Ireland. Egypt, Kuwait, Bahrain. We'll probably sell our joint venture interest in India.
Yeah.
And we're thinking about how do we compete in Asia in insurance in the modern world? And because that's not going to be through bank distribution or through the agency model, it'll be in a different model going forward. But the rest of the portfolio are typically number one and number two in their marketplace in very high growth, long-term growth markets. And so we're very fortunate with the portfolio that we've left ourselves with. And everybody else is now going down this restructuring route, you know, whether it's Standard Life or Pru or whatever, and they're going to be distracted because they've got to restructure their business. Whereas we've got the opposite, is that we've created a really focused business already with great management teams, got wonderful growth opportunities, and we've got technology that works.
Yeah. I guess as well as selling things that were obviously extraneous, like sort of some of the golf businesses, you also sold things like co-funds as well, which I guess is a space which the group would like to operate in and does operate in. Are you just attacking that market in a different way? Is LGIM doing that?
Yeah, we sort of bet on two horses, really. One co-fund and one on LGIM, and the LGIM horse won. So we've decided actually it's better to build everything out through LGIM and recruited great teams to help us do that. And, you know, LGIM's grown from 250 billion of assets under management to nearly a trillion of assets under management. And we're seeing great success. In 2016, we had net inflows from Europe of £2.5 billion into LGIM. Last year, it was £12.5 billion. If you'd asked me last year, when I said I thought we'd do a little bit better in Europe, you know, everybody has thought that wasn't possible with Brexit going on. Whereas, we got five times the volume of net flows. And clearly, America had a fantastic year as well, slightly more, but about £12.5 billion net inflows as well. And so we're seeing the fruits of our hard work coming to bear with sources of new flows from different geographies.
Okay. And I guess going the other direction from the decluttering, you've obviously made a few small deals, so Cala. I still think there's a little bit of puzzlement out there as to why life insurer owns a house builder. Could you just explain how, I know it fits into the whole housing strategy, but can you explain a little bit how to think about that and why you need to sort of vertically integrate that part of the business?
Yeah, it's a sort of an interesting question. I think the first big question is we sold mature savings for about £650 million. We've replaced all the lost earnings through spending £315 million on Cala. So from a shareholder value point of view, we've created equal amount of earnings, but have about £335 million left in the bank after we've done that. One business is in decline, the other business is growing. We have a very big housing ecosystem where, you know, we have a mortgage origination business, which is about 65 billion. So one in four, one in five of all mortgages in the UK originated through us. The largest surveying business. We have a huge home contents insurance business. We've got a build to rent business, an affordable business, and a build to sell business in housing. So we've got a fairly large housing ecosystem, which we've evolved over the last sort of 20 years. And we've had a 50% interest in Cala for a few years now. We bought it in 2013 when the revenue was about 250 million. It's now 750 million. So we've trebled the size of it in 3.5 years, which has been a good success story for us. And it's another one of these massive market failures we've had in the UK in the whole real assets area. And as you know, we're creating real assets which eventually flow into the LGR business or the LGIM business. LGIM has about 18 different real asset funds. And so that whole area of housing and infrastructure and urban regeneration and energy just creates assets which we move into LGC, LGR or LGIM in a very synergistic way, which optimizes returns for our shareholders.
So I guess you've got if you look at Cala Homes as a sort of producing units type of business, you've also got LNG Homes, which is I'm going to call it flat pack housing, you're going to get annoyed with me, but the precision engineered housing business. How is that going, and how important is the ability to produce these?
I think from the group point of view, it's not going to move the dial in any way whatsoever, but collectively across the whole of the housing ecosystem, we make an enormous amount of money for shareholders. But they're all bits of a jigsaw that stick together and hang together incredibly well, and synergies across all the bits within it. And we're just very happy that for whatever reason, the UK has decided to underproduce housing of every tenure for the last 30 years, and has created this huge housing gap that we're very fortunate that we can fill.
Things like house building, I guess they've got a reputation for being sort of high ROE at the peak of the cycle, but being horribly cyclical. You've obviously, you know, Carly, you bought at a brilliant time in the cycle. You bought it from a PE owner. You know, how should we think about the cyclicality the housing business is bringing onto the balance sheet? Or is it all about the long-term assets?
Yeah, it's a bit like the bond market in one sense, is that we're just starting on the first wave of a bull market from a supply point of view. We've had a demand point of view for the last 30 years, which has resulted in excess demand and low supply. Hopefully we'll see a supply market equilibrium sort of emerge now so that we can produce more houses in Britain and make a more normal return. I mean, the house builders make a 40% return on equity, and it's even higher than ours. And we figure that there's, I'm going to say there's been 2 years in the last 30 years when house prices in nominal terms have decreased.
Yeah.
So there's clearly that was a big 2 years in 2008. But the market's incredibly attractive for all types. You know, later life living, for build to rent, which we'll be very big in, because that's an institution. You know, UK doesn't have an institutional asset class for housing. Very unusual in the world that we don't, given we're a housing obsessed nation. And we're determined to do that, is to create an institutional asset class for housing. And that'll be mainly owned by LGIM clients, but a little bit of it will be owned by the group.
Yeah. It's quite a complex model, isn't it? You've got a lot of revenue streams from housing-related things. You've got some of it, as you say, which is LGIM profit. Some of it is originating assets for the annuity company. Some of it originating assets, for the third parties, for PGGM, et cetera. You've got the protection business. You've got lifetime mortgages. Do you think it's clear to most investors what the overarching theme is with the housing business?
Probably not. Have we done a good enough job of communicating? Probably not around it. And that therefore, as we go through 2018 and beyond, as we should do some more education around, what we're doing and why we're doing it. And people were quite sceptical when we started doing stuff in Manchester and Salford and Leeds and Birmingham, Bristol and Cardiff. Now physically they see what we've done and the returns that we're making for it. And the difference we're making to the economics, Newcastle's growth rate is 4%. It's quicker, higher than London, and unemployment's lower than London. But very few people realise that. We're seeing the same in Cardiff, where companies like Legal & General have a profound impact because the capital that we can deploy in those areas across the different funds we have as a group and lead to a great societal outcome.
And the group's got quite a lot of liquidity. You've got some, I guess, unused proceeds from the back book sale. You've got retained earnings. You've also got quite a lot of liquidity in LGC. What are the sort of priorities for deploying that cash? And when you're looking at it, what sort of returns are you looking for? And how much is going to be sort of assets versus strategic acquisitions?
Well, first of all, we're looking for a decent investment bank. I don't know whether you know of any, John, that could come around and give us some good advice.
Sadly not.
You couldn't think of any. Okay, I will. I think we're not fond of large transformational deals. I think they've, with the very odd exception, they've destroyed a lot of value in financial services. We've got lots of bolt-on opportunities. I think the Elgin business is probably the priority for that, particularly in the United States, where we'd like to be a bit bigger. We've gone from zero to $190 billion of assets under management in the United States, all organic, very successful so far. We'd like to accelerate that growth. We're finding, we're getting lots of demand from customers, but we could speed up either through lifting out teams or bolt-on acquisitions to accelerate the growth, and that would be the first priority for the business. I mean, to be honest, at the moment, the model is working tremendously well with the odd bolt-on acquisition and a huge focus on organic opportunities, and it's resulting in an enormous buildup of cash. A year or so ago, people were worrying about the balance sheet and were we paying out too much in dividends, et cetera, et cetera. And none of that was true, but actually people worry about it. And it's a sort of feature of the modern investor that they're nervous about lots of things because we've had a bullish market for quite a long period of time, and people are trying to figure out what's the next thing that could be a catalyst for a downturn, rather than that. Is there still further upside in the cycle in certain businesses? And certainly, we would be more in the latter camp than the former camp.
So that the 10% EPS target, is that predicated on deploying that cash, or is that upside if you deploy
upside.
It? I'm sorry, okay. And then looking at the retirement business, obviously we had a massive trade last week with the Pru and Rossay sort of 12 billion annuity transaction. Those transactions seem to be getting bigger and bigger. What's the appetite? You've talked about a 17 billion pipeline, which I guess looked big until you saw a 12 billion transaction. Yeah, how do you think about the appetite there? How quickly is that market going to grow?
I think the UK market's $2 trillion potential, and the US is $3 trillion. So they're massive markets, of which only 4 or 5% have transacted so far. So there's many years to come. The technology, the financial technology is just getting better and better and better, and we've been leading the way in the way that we structure the assets to better fit the liabilities. But that is not going to go away, and so, again, it leads to a better outcome for everyone. So win-win-win all around, because the firms get rid of their liabilities, we pool all the risk together, and we create assets that better match those liabilities, and they tend to be UK-centric, and so that we've got UK assets matching UK liabilities, heavily diversified by geography, by region, by maturity, so that there's a really good solution to that. The fact is, a few years ago, if we'd said there's going to be £12 billion acquisition deals, people wouldn't have thought that was real. Our pipeline's the biggest it's ever been in the UK. It's the biggest it's ever been in the United States. And we're not fazed whether we do it, in the first 6 months, the second 6 months, this year or next year. I think we can hit our financial targets that we've set for us as a group, no matter what the scenario is for the PRT market.
So the US, you've done a few transactions, but I think it's still the UK has been leading the way, obviously, because that's the older business. You mentioned then that the size of the US market, obviously, theoretically, is bigger than the UK market. What do you think the catalyst is for the US market to grow faster from here, and what are you doing to actually sort of get something like the share you've got in the UK and the US?
Yeah, I mean, we did grow 60-70% last year, so it was not shabby growth, but it's measured growth. I think the thing we like to do is take it on rewarded risks and not avoiding unrewarded risk, because I think lots of people in financial services have taken on lots of unrewarded risk, and we're very happy with what we're doing. We did 15 deals in America last year. We've done two or three so far this year. That we're just in the building the business from a very solid base. And we did that in fund management, where we were very measured in how we expand. We've done it all organically. We'll probably do that the same in this business, and just build for a very long term. And so we've executed totally in line with the business plan so far, adding to the number of deals, growing the business at a reasonable amount every year. And the thing about compound growth is it is compound. Yeah. And so if we can continue to grow at the rate at which we're growing it, it'll be a very successful big business in a few years' time. And the same is true on the asset management side. It used to be, 5 or 10 billion. Now it's 190 billion. But it doubling it in America is not an outrageous goal, because as a market share, we're still very small in the United States, and we're happy to compete with pretty much anyone. BlackRock or Vanguard are competitors that we feel very comfortable in competing against.
And how's the origination working in the States? Because in the UK, obviously, you're entrenched in the DB index fund space. You know the consultants very well. The trustees know you. The sponsors know you. Obviously, the brand is building in the States, but you're still relatively new.
No, I mean, in one sense, we've been there 10 years, and the LDI business, which is the source of lots of our business in the UK, we're huge in LDI in the United States already, and that was the strategy, was actually to go with LGIM/LDI in America, build up the capability, build up all the client network. And so we've got 320 DB pension clients already in the United States who provide future buy-in and buy-out opportunities for us as a firm. So we did it, in a sense, the right way around. We've launched our index funds last year for the first time. We're obviously get a good flow from the index business. We'll launch our multi-asset business and our real asset business. And so our asset management capability will align with our PRT capability and our LDI capability. And we'll repeat the model that's been very successful for us here in the UK in the United States. And we can't see any impediment to doing that. And it's all about getting great people. we've got the best people we've ever had, we've got the best businesses we've ever had, we've got the best technology, and we're performing it with the highest ROE we've ever had in the history of the company. So we're feeling pretty good and pretty confident about the way. And we've got nothing, no drags on the business. You know, we haven't got underperforming businesses, or we're in geographies that we don't want to be in. We're in the right geographies and seeing the right growth opportunities, great teamwork that's going on across the firm at the moment.
So the UK business has obviously got the massive strength of the asset origination capability and what you've done in private assets. I guess in the US you don't have that piece yet, and you were alluding to sort of LGIM acquisitions. I think you've spoken in the past about doing something in private debt in particular. So how much of an impediment?
But the private debt we've sorted out. We've gone down the organic route. So we do build buy analysis. We're very disciplined about build buy analysis. And so in America, we decided to go down the private debt route with our own team based in Chicago, and that's already proving to be pretty successful for us. On the physical real assets, we've been looking at bolt-ons for quite a while. It's the chemistry that's difficult, you know, because we want people to fit culturally with us, and we want them to be integrated with us, whereas lots of people want to stay as an independent, and basically they just want an equity provider, and that's not what we want to do as a firm. So we may well end up going down the build route in America as well, but we are at the moment still looking for bolt-on acquisitions in that space.
Okay. So I think when people look at the group, they see, you know, an increasingly international asset management business, and then an annuity business, an insurance business, which is still quite domestic. If we look forward in 2 or 3 years' time, you know, is the retirement business going to be far more? Well, is the US going to be a far bigger part of the retirement business than it is currently?
I think the insurance business will be bigger as well. I think the US is probably the most inefficient insurance business in the world for all sorts of odd reasons, and so there's a lot of opportunity to replicate what we've done in the UK, which is much more digital than we've done in the United States, and take our UK model into the United States. The PRT business will just follow the fund management business and becoming bigger in the United States. And again, there's nothing stopping us from doing that. And so we're extraordinarily confident that, you know, the US will be a huge growth opportunity for us as a firm.
And how do the returns compare on the US PRT business versus the sort of bulk business in the UK? Because I guess you're writing under the local US rules, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, we've not got the competitive advantages in the United States that we have here. You know, we've been in the business for over 30 years here. We've built up a huge franchise. We've got all this origination capability in the UK that we don't have in the United States. And so both can earn well above our cost of capital.
Yeah.
So we're happy with that, but at the moment the UK return would be better than the US return.
Okay, just because of scale?
Because of scale and capability. I think we've got much better origination capabilities in the UK. You know, we were given this market opportunity because nobody else wanted to do it, and it turned out to be, you know, fantastic for us as a firm, and we'll build on that success here in the UK. We think we can replicate it in the United States. We may partner with somebody, and there are two or three people who've been talking about partnering with us on parts of the asset origination in the United States.
So it's really an asset strategy issue in the States, the sort of technical side of it. You've got the capability already, it's just...
Oh, we've got the customers. Yeah. You know, we've got all the LDI customers. So we've got four of the largest pension funds in America, four of the top five pension funds already as clients, and 315 others. And the client base just keeps getting bigger and better every time I go over to America, and the morale and enthusiasm in the Chicago office is off the scale.
And then coming back to the UK, the lifetime mortgage business, you have only been in that for a few years. I think last year was £1 billion of advances, I think. I think you sort of beat Aviva to the number one spot. How much is that business about sort of profit centre in its own right, and how much of it is about generating backing assets for the annuities?
I think both. I think we spent 10 years considering whether to get into the lifetime mortgage market or not. So it was a very measured judgment to do it. And then we got a lot of support from the Treasury, the FCA in particular, and people really see the benefits. So, you know, in a low interest environment with reasonably high house prices, then it makes a huge amount of sense from a customer point of view to use a lifetime mortgage to supplement their lifestyle. And lots of people think of housing as their pension. And people are realizing that actually it's a pretty pain-free way. And we've got a phenomenally innovative management team who work very closely with the regulator on developing products that meet customers' needs even better than they have in the past. And we've gone from, you know, 0% market share to 35% market share in 2 years.
Yeah.
But that's all through new growth rather than sort of winning business off other people. We've just seen new growth. And the barrier there is the number of advisors, because it's a highly advised product. And therefore, the constraint is the number of advisors who are trained to sell the product and sell it proficiently and efficiently in that market. That's the barrier.
And I guess from a sort of risk point of view, that product has got a sort of well-discussed sort of tail risk in terms of the no negative equity guarantee. You know, how do you think about that? And has your view on that changed in the last couple of years? I guess, you know, a lot of international investors are worried about Brexit, impact on UK house prices, etc. These things start out at a very low LTV, but how do you get comfortable with that tail risk?
Yeah, I mean, it is a tail risk, and, you know, we typically the LTV is somewhere between 20 and 25%. Typical customer is about 72. And so if even with nominal price, you know, zero price house price inflation, they've got to live to about 102 before it becomes an issue. And so having a very large number of people live to 102, there's, you know, zero probability of that happening. And so that therefore it's a sort of isolated tail risk, which, you know, the maths in a very low interest rate, because if you're compounding at say 4.5 or 5%, that's very different from compounding at 7 or 8%. And when these products are sold in yesteryear, they were sold at 7, 8, 9% compounding just before house prices collapsed. So those two things weren't ideal for that. Whereas now we're in a very good environment for the product.
And with those products, as well as underwriting security, do you also do a longevity underwriting process as well? Is it sort of treated like a reverse annuity, do you, when you're doing the underwriting, or is it?
No, it is, yes. I mean, in a sense, people forget we still take longevity risk in our individual annuity market business, the US, and as you said at the start, we've got huge releases coming from that because everyone has been too cautious and too prudent in thinking what's going to happen, even though the trends have been here for a lot of years, is that, you know, people are dying much quicker than we thought, and America's leading the way in that. But the same is true in the UK and large parts of the Western world, is that people are dying quicker than we thought, and are continuing to die quicker than we thought, and therefore we've got releases in 18 and 19. And we got £250 million of cash out of the release in 2017, and we should do better than that in 2018 and 2019.
So this release is, I think you said in the results, you've only really taken part of the improvement, and you've got another 2-3 years of trend to bring through. So within the annuity book, I guess one of the pushback we get from investors on your stock is just, you know, how big annuities are as part of the whole profit mix now. How comfortable are you with annuities as part of the mix? And is there a ceiling you look at there, or are you just looking at it in terms of what the risk-adjusted profit is, and you're not too fussed about what the overall proportion gets to?
No, it's a very good question, I think. I think we've separated the two businesses now into the global PRT business and the individual retirement business. And the individual retirement business is a UK business, which includes lifetime mortgages and everything else. So we're already mixing, you know, different things in together in terms of the retirement business. You'll see the individual retirement business evolve in a very different way in the UK, and that will become a big profit centre, and it's all right. It's about 15% of the group's profit at the moment. You know, do we think the retirement business in the UK is going to be bigger or smaller in the years to come? Well, there's 700,000 people per annum now retiring in Britain, and they're looking for solutions, and we're, you know, the market leader in that. And so that naturally, that portfolio businesses which are going to come under that are going to grow. You know, whether we, what proportion of that are annuities, I couldn't tell you, but I think there'll be lots of other products and services alongside that going forward. So we'll see that growing, be more diversified than it is at the moment. The PRT business will be both the UK and the United States. And we certainly have a risk appetite to do more of it, but we think LGC and LGIM will both be able to match the pace of growth for the annuity business.
Okay. So to what extent does the longevity risk diversifies nicely, but the credit risk, I think people are more skeptical about whether the credit risk diversifies or just aggregates. How do you think about the aggregate group appetite for credit?
Well, I think we've gone into direct investments, we've gone into lifetime mortgages. You'd say that those, the credit risk is diverse, you know, it's getting diversified because of that. We've been into different geographies. We've obviously got a European portfolio, a US portfolio, and a UK portfolio. And we're in lots of different sectors. If you go back 10 years, it was hugely dominated by one sector and one geography, which is UK banks,
yeah,
or the banking industry in the UK. And that was what we needed to get the maturity and to match the assets and liabilities. We've got a much better diversified portfolio and a bit of lifetime mortgages, some directs, you know, geographically across Europe, the UK and the United States, and by different sector. So the banking share now is about 3 or 4% of the total portfolio, and includes, yeah, you know, such high value added names like Morgan Stanley.
So when you're looking at the overall risk of the business, I think, you know, the market is very much not just your stock, but also a lot of the other UK life companies. It is principally preoccupied with credit from a sort of macro downside scenario. When you're talking with the board about the things that could derail the strategy, that could, you know, cause a material fall in the share price, do you talk about credit, or are there other things that you're worried about?
We talk about credit because investors are concerned about credit, and that's why. I mean, we've still got 8 billion of gilts, effectively, in the, yeah, the portfolio. And if you were a shareholder, you'd say, why do you have 8 billion of gilts? So there isn't a good answer, yeah, for that. Is that that's just future profits for us as a group as we switch out of that and into other types of assets. We've got a 2.7 billion credit default provision, which, if we were a bank, that would probably be 300 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fact that, you know, for whatever reason, our industry has a huge buffer for credit default compared to the banking industry. Nobody ever, you know, just sat through, listened to banking presentations. There's very little on credit defaults, whereas we probably have 10 times the size of the provision, yeah, or 8 times the size of the provision that a bank would have for the same sort of assets. Ours is a single A rated portfolio of assets, investment grade. We've been in the business for 30 years. The total credit defaults we've had, the defaults we've had in that, is somewhere between 35 and 50 million over, yep, 30 years. So it's a portfolio that doesn't default much, but partially because, you know, the insurance analysts don't have to deal with credit in a huge way, and banking, yep, analysts do, that, you know, banks seem to have a tiny proportion of default provisions, but that people are comfortable with that. We have a, yep, huge amount of it, but people still worry about it, even though we've got a 30-year track record of having, yep, very few defaults. And we've probably got the best asset manager in the world looking after it for in LGIM, recognized, yeah, by pension funds throughout the world, has been brilliant at doing this particular job. Somehow, yeah, that they're going to fail on the internal client, I don't think so.
So when you look at how the market perceives your stock, is that the biggest sort of perception gap versus what your view of the world is?
I think people are still worried about Brexit. You know, if, yeah, I look at the buyers, and notwithstanding the fact that we put out 2-3, you know, we didn't think the economy would fall over when the vote happened. We expected the vote to leave, and it did happen. So we planned for that. That there's a, you know, very robust job market in the UK. It's 32.1 million people have jobs, 75% employment rate, 800,000 vacancies. So the economy's in reasonably good shape. But people are still nervous about that. And what's the implications, yeah, of that? You know, when the vote happened, our share price fell 25% on the day, which told you that, you know, what people were really nervous about. It wasn't right to be nervous about it, but actually, you know, you only know that with hindsight. And so I think people are worried about that. I think, and it's very hard to convince people that shouldn't be a worry. You know, we think the economy won't fall over, that, you know, growth will continue to be, you know, okay. We think, you know, outside of London, it's probably going to be stronger than London.
Yeah.
Or equal to London, which it hasn't been for the last 30 years. And so that's good for us as a business. If rates rise a bit, that's good for us. If credit spreads, yeah, widen a bit, that's good for us. So the scenarios that people have are actually good for us as a firm. But, you know, it's sort of counterintuitive to investors, yeah, that's the case. But we will only see as we continue to deliver great results. As we continue to deliver great results, then investor concerns will fall away.
Because you've had some institutional investor interest in some of the assets in sort of fairly regional bits of the UK that you might not expect international investors to be interested in. So you're pretty confident about the domestic credit book, are you, and how it would...
Yeah, I mean, that was, you know, it's great to write strategy with hindsight. And so hindsight would say, you know, this is a brilliant move. And in fact, you know, we knew that international investors would buy assets in Manchester and Leeds and Cardiff and Bracknell and places like that. Clearly we didn't. And that's been good, that actually through this whole period, we've had institutional investors buying UK assets, which has been obviously very good for us. And institutional investors have come in to support our build-to-rent effort. And so they've actually recognise that whilst we've made it a £1 billion business at the moment, we could easily make it £10 billion given the amount of institutional investor demand there is for assets in the UK, because we've never created an institutional asset management business for housing in the UK, and every other market pretty much has one. Yeah. So that's going to happen here.
And just turning to LGIM, you mentioned, or Mark mentioned, that the results are more of a focus on factor-based investing, ESG, you've got the ETF business you've bought. Obviously, that, you know, the passive and the active fixed income business has served you very well. Is this a new phase of growth? Is this a new product categories, or is this what your clients in existing geographies are demanding?
No, I think it's a new, I mean, you know, we're going to grow the existing business, the new products, and new geographies, so it's kind of win-win-win for us as a firm. We had net inflows of $45 billion last year. That's pretty much the size of a reasonable-sized UK fund management business. And, you know, again, if you go back 8 to 9 years and said, you know, we're going to turn something that's under $300 billion into a trillion, we've all had a bit of a giggle about it, but actually that's what we've done. And the net flows into the business are going to continue to be very strong.
Okay, I think we've got some time for some questions from the floor. Does anybody have a question for Nigel? Julian, in the front row here, please.
Hi Nigel, I have a quick question about pensions auto-enrollment. So I think the UK has gone from, it's going from 2% now to 5% this year and 8% next year. How is that impacting you?
Well, we're in the very early, you know, days. I think the thing about auto-enrollment that was a surprise to everyone, originally people were expecting about 60% auto-enrollment. We've ended up with 92% auto-enrollment, and pensions, particularly in a world in which housing is going to be less of an investment opportunity for those going into pensions, and they won't be viewing the house with the same degree of house price appreciation. People have become much more familiar with putting money aside for their pensions. Even young people who've been highly engaged in the auto-enroll process. Do we think that most people continue to pay in? Yes, is the answer to that. Do we think it's the right thing from a society point of view? Yes. Do we think we'll have more flexibility as well on what people will be allowed to invest in terms of, you know, more in infrastructure, more in venture capital and areas which are good for the economy, which are going to be good for us? The answer to that is yes. So we've gone from being sort of an also-ran in the DC pension space to being number one in the DC pension space with $69 billion of assets under management just here in the UK. Will that be a £200 billion business in a few years' time? Yes. Just you know, the law of large numbers and compound growth are going to get us to that space. Will we have a better asset mix going forward? Yes. So it's you know, the long-term trends in that are tremendously positive. Can we predict exactly what the rate's going to be of growth? Not really, because, you know, we still got to get through the 5% hump and the 8% hump around that. But the level of engagement and the has been enormous, and the interest by corporates. And the corporate world's done a really good job. You know, they very rarely get praise, including some of the banks. They've done a great job of communicating with their staff and getting people to sign up and get interested in pensions, which is a good thing to do.
Okay. Do we have another question? Julian again.
Can I ask, I mean, I know, how do you expect to be affected by IFRS 17 for the accounting on annuities?
How are we going to be affected by it? IFRS 17 could come in 2021, 2022. It's going to result in a huge amount of work, I think, and yet another bonanza for the consulting firms in terms of doing things. Is it going to change our business model? No, I don't think it's going to change it at all. Will it change some of the ways that we may or may not recognise profits? Possibly, it'll probably may cause us to upfront more profit than we currently do, which we've been, you know, in the very prudent at the moment, and that's kind of always suited us as a firm. That may change going forward, but it's, you know, from an investor point of view, it's not going to change the business model. It's not going to change the underlying economics. It may result in some extra additional upfront profit recognition, which people will see through anyway.
And on a related topic, there's speculation about the PRA changing the risk margin. And I think you've been one of the sort of principal lobbyists behind that for many years. Do you think that's going to happen? And if it does, what impact does it have on the business from here?
Yeah, I mean, we had a very good Treasury Select Committee, and I'd like to thank my other panel members on the home team. The away team were, of course, the PRA. But it was a proper discussion and debate with the PRA about what's the right outcome. And I think, to be fair to Sam and the team, they've done a very good job of thinking through what are the, and again, had a very measured approach. Certainly Sam's recent comments and David Rule's recent comments are that they will change it, and hopefully in 2018, if not in 2019, that's going to bring some relief to investors around that, and hopefully it will allow us to take on some more longevity in the UK. We already take it all on in the United States and outside of the UK, and we take it all on in the individual business, so we never stop doing it in the individual business. But we've been reinsuring 80 or 90% of the front book UK business. It's only going to be good. How good is good? And I'm happy with good. If it's very good, that would be even better. But I know it's going to be good.
So does it materially change? Are you going to materially change the amount of reinsurance you use? Or
it depends. I mean, it's not going to be less. Yeah. And so we'll make more profit for the group as a consequence of that, and it's good for UK PLC if that happens. But the exact number, we'll have to wait and see how the PRA draft their final change in the terms.
Okay, thank you. Time for one last question. Someone's got a question. That was very quiet. So just looking at LGIM, the US has obviously been a big success, and that's ramping quite quickly. You've talked a lot about Asia, Middle East, etc. You mentioned Europe earlier, but I think the group's been relatively quiet about Europe, and given it's on the doorstep and you've got a lot of things in the UK that work very well, what is the opportunity there?
Well, I think we have an immense opportunity as I said, we went from 2.5 to 12.5 billion in one year by just applying ourselves better. We've now got the ETF business as well, and the ETF, since we bought the business, sales are up 25%. So we got off to a good start. Usually, you come back to conferences and say, we're just doing some integration, and sales are lagging behind because of we can't integrate it. Well, the opposite's been true, is that we've integrated our colleagues really well. They're sitting in Coleman Street, or about to sit in Coleman Street, and be very much part of the team and the culture. And we're really looking forward to driving the ETF business in Europe, which will give us another narrative to talk to investors about. And there's tons of demand for real assets, for new real assets. We can't originate enough to keep up with customer demand, really. So we're hoping that we'll get opportunities both on the supply and the demand side in Europe as we go forward.
So the intention is to build out a sort of euro-denominated real asset business as well.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, we just got started in Asia, and we've now got an office, small office in Japan, and we've got a small office in Hong Kong, and we're getting a lot of inbound calls that as a consequence of that. And now we've just got to execute.
And is there a chance that the insurance company follows behind the asset management company?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, we did it the wrong way around elsewhere. Yep. We went in with insurance, and with old legacy insurance businesses. We've now sold all of them, gone in with the fund management business, which has got off to a great start, and now we can follow up with the insurance business in due course with a very UK-centric type model, very digital. Yep. We think we're pretty much as good as anybody in the world at doing this, with the exception of the two Chinese companies.
So you can basically rebuild some of the international insurance footprint, but in different markets than you had previously?
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
Okay, brilliant. Nigel, thank you very much. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you.